Well, this is Robert Frost, and Robert Frost is one of my favorites. That's what I was doing this week, Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, and Robert Frost. And the order was because someone who was leaving wanted to hear Emily Dickinson. She, chronologically, she should have been after Walt Whitman, but that's not important. She's as modern as Walt Whitman. In fact, maybe more modern, certainly more modern in technique. We were talking a little bit the last couple of days about why some poets are modern and some aren't modern, and what that means. Dickinson was modern for her technical virtuosity, the way she rhymed, her line lengths, and the way she got at a problem. And Whitman was modern because he was part of the westward expansion, the unlimited frontier of America, and all that kind of thing. So now we come to Robert Frost, who is not modern at all in any of those senses. He's modern because he's a modern poet. He's of our time. But in fact, he died in, 61, I think, 62, thereabouts. Well, maybe 63, because he was at Kennedy's inauguration, which would have been, 60? Yeah. Yeah. What?
The sun was in his eyes.
Yes. Yes. And he was reading that poem that he had written, and if those of you remember that, the sun was in his eyes, and there was a little electrical short in the lectern thing that he was using, and the little smoke billowed out, and the wind was whistling, and it must have been 10 degrees on that inauguration day. And he said, "Oh, the hell with it." And he grabbed the poem and then read another poem that he had by memory, because he couldn't work with that one anymore. It was typical Frost, very crusty son of a gun. Those were good days when a president would have a poet in the White House, and Pablo Casals and other really good people. We haven't seen the like of that. I don't know who Jimmy Carter has had or will have by way of the arts in the White House. I suspect that he will do something, and maybe already has. I haven't been home since June, so maybe he's done great and mighty things already.
Didn't he have James Dickey?
I think he did, yeah. I think he made James Dickey the spokesman of something or other. James Dickey is a good Southerner, a good Georgian. That may have something to do with it. And James Dickey's a good poet. I'll give him that. And a good first novelist. If you haven't read Deliverance, I recommend that to you. I think it's an awfully good novel, particularly for someone's first novel. I think it's
Did they make a movie out of that?
Yes, they did. Yeah, it wasn't. The movie was good too. I thought that was a very powerful movie. Not as gripping as the book, but that's kind of a cliche. But gripping enough in some scenes, maybe for some of the people in the audience. I saw it in Lincoln, Nebraska. It was a bit gripping for some. This is Robert Frost, at any rate. And when I say he's not new, he's not modern, because Frost wasn't looking for ways to experiment with language. Frost said all that can be done with languages or with words is soon told. He said there's only a certain amount of things you can do. Cat is cat and dog is spelled dog. And let's leave it at that and see what I can do with poems. So his language is very colloquial, very conversational, very common. His themes are common. He is an uncommon poet because he's Robert Frost. And I can't explain how that happens. That's part of the mystery of art, it seems to me. How he does what he does using the tools that he does is what makes Robert Frost. Robert Frost is like Hemingway in language. Tends to be economical, and he doesn't get artsy-craftsy. He's not cute. He doesn't try to overpower you with symbol. He says, "I'm going to write a poem about a barn. It's going to be about a barn. I'll write a poem about a moo cow. It's going to be about a moo cow." And a lot of people try to, some of my students imitate Frost, and that's good, because I tell them, I encourage them to imitate people for a while until they get on their own feet or their own pen. And people try to imitate Ernest Hemingway and his style, and it's almost impossible to write like Hemingway. But some of my students read Hemingway's novels and says, what he's talking about fishing, the fishing was good, the water was clean, it was a good day, the fishing was fine. And then he goes on like that, and so my students say, this is literature, the fishing was good, it's like Sea Puff Run. I can do that. It was a good day, the sky was clear, the fishing was fine. So they'll go back and they'll write a story where they use these little ones, little pithy sentences, and it sounds like Sea Puff Run. They said, but that's what Ernest Hemingway did. Well, there's the mystery. You can't at last explain how Hemingway does it and someone else doesn't. I don't think you can explain it. You can talk about it, but that's about as close as you can come. Well, take a look at a poem on the very bottom of the page called The Pasture. The first stanza and the second stanza is on the top of the second page. I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. I'll only stop to rake the leaves away and wait to watch the water clear, I may. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. I'm going out to fetch the little calf that's standing by the mother. It's so young it totters when she licks it with her tongue. I shan't be gone long. You come, too. Now that is Robert Frost. And those of you who are here for some of the Whitman or Dickinson, you can, if you've read any other poets, and I know many of you have, then you can, the difference becomes immediately apparent. And Frost is not dealing in symbol. He's not dealing in a hidden agenda. He says, I'm going out to clean the pasture spring. And why is he doing that? For the simplest of reasons, because he had a pasture spring that needed cleaning. He says, I'm going to go clean it. And that is pure Robert Frost. Obviously, Robert Frost talks about more things besides cleaning pasture springs and mending walls and picking apples and things like, and moo cows and stuff. He does have a little darker side, and he does deal in some other kinds of things, but he does it in a rather open manner. He's maybe the most unsymbolic poet of modern American poets. He does have symbols. Everybody, every time you talk, you use symbols. You can't help it. But his symbols are out in front. And when you get to his dark side, some of the poems are a little harder to get at. They're still not hard by comparison with other people. But he was a farmer, a bad farmer. His grandfather left him a couple of farms. And I visited them this last summer, a year ago, this July, I guess, in New Hampshire and in Vermont. And it was fun just going up and down the hills, beautiful Vermont and New Hampshire, knocking on doors of little stores saying, where's the Frost farm? And it was, here's some more of these handouts. So maybe pass those back. It was fun just to see the look on some of the people's faces. They said, whose farm? Jones? I said, no, Frost. They say, Frost? Joe Frost? I said, no, Robert Frost. We don't have a Robert Frost. I said, no, he's dead. What do you want to see a dead person's farm? And I had driven to New England assuming, pardon me, that Robert Frost would have been a monument by this time. And of course everybody would know where his farm was. Well, it wasn't true. There were some who would know, but most of them were not inclined to be excited about it. So I went to many farms until I found the right farm. And one farm I knocked on the door and the woman immediately opened and said, no, Robert Frost never lived here. And shut the door. But I did find them, and one in particular in South Shaftesbury, Vermont, which is going to be one of my favorite places in the world, I think. It's a beautiful little town in the country. And I drove up this wine about a 200-yard lane to a farm, a little very modest white farm, a little barn in the back. An artist had bought it and put a studio on top of the barn. He said, sure, go look around, just wander around. So I wandered around in the back, and in the back of this farm was a little rolling hillside going away into the distance with lots of trees and a little stream coming down, forming a little pool of water lilies. Mm-hmm. And there was a girl there from Pittsburgh. I don't know what she was doing there. She had on a most unlikely South Shaftesbury-looking dress. Well, really these long, flowing, I don't know what, silk or chiffon or whatever. It was very filmy kind of stuff with long sleeves like these, only way down like this. And her hair was blowing in the wind, and she had flowers in her hair, and she had two Irish setter dogs with her. And I just came around the corner of the house, and here this vision was wafting through the grass, and these setters, and I stopped. I wow, if Frost could see this, he'd write about something besides the pasture. But maybe not. But it was a beautiful sight. It seemed like everything just seemed to go together on that particular day. Well, anyway, Frost lived in New England and wrote about New England, and his poems are of the earth, and that's why I like Robert Frost. Let's take a look at mowing, the top of the first page. There was never a sound beside the wood but one, and that was my long sighs whispering to the ground. What was it whispered? I know not well myself. Perhaps it was something about the heat of the sun, something perhaps about the lack of sound, and that was why it whispered and did not speak. It was no dream of the gift of idle hours or easy gold at the hand of fay or elf. Anything more than the truth would have seemed too weak to the earnest love that laid the swale and rose. Not without feeble-pointed spikes of flowers, pale orchises, and scared a bright green snake. The fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. My long scythe whispered and left the hay to make. That's also typical Frost. The rhyme, it's a sonnet, and a lot of times Frost is a beautiful sonneteer, and sonnets are very hard for him to master, and he does it very conversationally, and you're not concerned that he's writing a sonnet. He's writing a poem about going down to the pasture with his long scythe and cutting grass or whatever, weeds or whatever. That's what you're concerned about, because you can almost feel it in your hands. And when we get to the poem after apple picking, you can hear the apples rumbling in. You can feel your foot on the ladder rung. In fact, he's got a line about that, how instep keeps the round of the ladder rung on his foot. He's talking about simple things, but Frost always manages to say something a little bit more important than just what he's saying on the surface. Lines like anything more, right in the middle, anything more than the truth would have seemed too weak. That's a typical Frost line. Anything more than truth. He's out there cutting weeds, he's cutting grass, or whatever he's doing. That is the fact, that is the act. He's sweating, he's hot, and when he's through, he's seeing he's accomplished this much. He's got this much cleared, and that has been a good thing to do. It's been a good day. Anything more than that would be weakness. If he embellished it, if he talked too much about it, in other words, doing that is better than all the education, all the philosophy, and Frost would say all the theology, certainly all the symbolism in the world. Just grab your scythe, go down to the river, and spend a couple hours in the hot sun clearing some weeds, and you'll know all there is to know about life. And that's Frost. And then the next to the last line, the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. He's saying the same thing again. The fact, accomplishing of one fact, whether you're washing the dishes, taking a walk by yourself, the 10-mile creek, whatever it might be, the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows. That the doing of it is its own reward. And Frost is full of that kind of rather homely sentiment, but decent. He's not hokey about it. Rod McEwen could say the same thing, and it would be cloying, for me at least, almost too sentimental. Frost says it right out in front, and you accept it, you believe it. The fact that that's a sonnet, we could talk about that, but I don't think that's necessary. That maybe some other time you could get into that. Suffice it to say that a sonnet is 14 lines of iambic pentameter. It's a very structured form. Very rigid. He only has a certain amount of room to play with, and that's it. And if you're good enough, that's all you need. You can say anything you want in that structure. A lot of times, I get into sonnets in creative writing class for about a week. That's all they can take, and all I can take to it, to read them. And they say there's not enough freedom. Then I show them Robert Frost, and I show them Pope in the 18th century, who could say anything he wanted to in form and structure. So the structure doesn't matter. If you're good, it doesn't matter if the structure is not. This business of being able to say the fact is the sweetest dream that labor knows, and anything more than the truth would seem too weak, is illustrative of one of Frost's truisms, where he said a poem should begin in delight and end in wisdom. That's what a poem should do. And almost all of Frost's do that. He'll start out light, talking about something, and before you know it, he's turned a corner somewhere, and it's taken on universal proportions. It becomes a truism, something you can live by. He says that's what a poem should do. But it should begin in delight, just talking about something easy, and you sneak up on him. Not like Emily Dickinson, who drops a safe out of this 10-story window on your head, and she just crushes you with that tremendous impact she has. And Whitman, of course, just is so expansive, he's just gathering in all the time, left and right, with the tentacles. But Frost just kind of sits on the front porch and whittles a little bit and tells you a story. And before you know it, he's got you. Reluctance on the same page. Out through the fields and the woods and over the walls I have wended. I have climbed the hills of you and looked at the world and descended. I have come by the highway home, and lo, it is ended. The leaves are all dead on the ground, save those that the oak is keeping to ravel them one by one and let them go scraping and creeping out over the crusted snow when others are sleeping. And the dead leaves lie huddled and still, no longer blown hither and thither. The last lone aster is gone. The flowers of the witch hazel wither. The heart is still aching to seek, but the feet question whither. Ah, when to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with the grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? Isn't that, I think that's brilliant. Mm-hmm. The metaphor of nature, and before you know it, he's talking about us. When to the heart of man was it ever less than a treason to go with the drift of things, to yield with a grace to reason, and bow and accept the end of a love or a season? Beautiful. And you notice he doesn't overstate it. He just states his premise, asks the question, and just kind of quietly backs off and lets you think about it. A lesser writer would have just, he couldn't have resisted this and said, now you see my point is, and we'd have three more verses there. Until finally you say, I really do get it, you know. You're insulting my intelligence. It's the hardest thing in writing is not to overwrite. Maybe the hardest thing is just to do it, I suppose. But once you've started, to know when to stop. Absolutely crucial. He stops. Right on. Look at the second stanza. That's just a delight because it's just one sentence. It just keeps on going. Isn't that nice? Just one continuous thought flows. Then you notice it's a nice thought. He said it in a pleasing manner. Then you start looking at the poem. You say, hey, he's got some rhyme in there. Son of a gun. Then he's got some meter. I mean, you get into the poem, you find out how much technical stuff Frost is throwing at you. But he does it in such an easy way, as they say in Holden, casual excellence, that you're not concerned about it. Subliminally, you pick this up. I think your psyche knows you're dealing with form and structure, and you feel good about that. But he does it like maybe no one else in poetry. He doesn't intrude. It's very natural. In fact, Frost was so good at rhyme and saying things in meter, it was absolutely second nature to him. He was having dinner once with a couple of Jesuit priests, and they were talking over eating spaghetti and drinking some good red wine and talking about heavy theological issues. And they finally turned to Frost and said, what do you think of original sin? And between sips of wine, he said, it's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. And the priest stopped, looked at each other, and that was the end of the conversation. He had just summed it up, just like that. That takes quite a mind to be able to do that. Quite a facility for words. He said, writing poetry without rhyme is like playing tennis without a net. He liked the challenge of the rhyme. He liked the challenge of having the form. He has written free verse, but very, very little. He's written quite a bit of blank verse. Blank verse is when you have no rhyme, but you have the same beats every line. It's iambic pentameter, five beats, pa-pump, 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 but no rhyme. And that lends itself to telling stories, narrative poems, and Frost is maybe the best narrative poet going. Death of a Hired Man is an absolute gem of narrative poem, I think. Let's save that a little bit, because that's heavy. Well, how about, what would you like to read? What would you like to hear? I've got others in the book, too, so we're not going to run out of time before I run out of Frost. Road Not Taken? Okay. It's on the bottom of page something. I wish I had been as brilliant as Frost when Mr. Offelman, my eighth grade teacher, was haranguing me with original sin. And I could have said, it's from their having stood contrasted that good and bad so long have lasted. Mr. Offelman would have killed me on the spot. No doubt about it. I don't think Frost would have thought of that when he was 12 either, though. I hope not. I'd like to have to think there's some hope. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim because it was grassy and wanted wear. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves, no step had trodden black. Oh, I kept the first for another day. Yet knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh somewhere, ages and ages hence. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Of course, that poem is anthologized just all over the place, all high school anthologies, college anthologies, grade school anthologies, thank God now. There are finally some good anthologies and some good literature books for grade school kiddos. I went through, when I was teaching grade school, about as good as I could do was Scott Forsman. It was Sea Pup Run, and then for the fifth grade they read inspiring stories like Cousin Jill at the Dude Ranch. And none of my fifth grade boys gave a rip for Cousin Jill at the Dude Ranch or Cousin Jill anywhere else. And they, the whole generation of people growing up not caring much for reading. You get tired of seeing Spot and Puff running about on the floor and Jill doing her thing. You know, notice the conversational tone in this poem? Frost is the great conversational poet, and like his structure, he does it so easily that it doesn't intrude. Second stanza. He's telling you which path he took. Now, you've got it right off the bat. You've got to concede that this is a pretty homely topic. Mm-hmm. A guy standing and saying, oh, I took a walk the other day. Well, if you're going to say we're going to walk down to 10 Mile Creek, you're not going to go into four stanzas telling me about it. Say, oh, we're going to go to 10 Mile Creek. Okay, that's all I need to know. You don't want to stand there and tell me, you know, a 15-minute discourse on why you're going to 10 Mile Creek. And when you almost got there, this road went off. Frost does it. He just assumes that's going to be great stuff for you to hear. And I'll be darned if it isn't. How does he do that? I don't want to know about his walk. I've got my own walks. But I find myself reading this every year for 25 years. He says, I was going to take this one. Long I stood there, and you know, I could see clear almost to the ballpark, and I could see where the roads are going to branch. He says, then I took the other. That's just as good, just as fair. And having perhaps the better claim, that's the one I want because it's got weeds and somebody ought to walk on that. And then he says, though as for that, he tells you which one he's going to take, and he says, well, come to think of it, the other one is just as much, just as good. I could have taken that one. See that conversational tone? He's thinking out loud, and he lets us hear him think. Nobody else can do that. It's very, very difficult to do. It's so easily, it sounds so easy. Though as for that, the passing there had worn them really about the same. And both that morning equally lay in leaves no step had trodden black. Then he says, oh, I kept the first for another day. And then he changes again. Yet, come to think of it, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubt if I'll ever come back. He thinks his way through the poem, and we're listening to this thought process, and I'll be darned if it doesn't turn out as poetry rather than just thinking. There's a difference. And my students find this very, very difficult to figure out how that's done. Because a poem is art. And when you're through it, it had better be art, not just thinking out loud. It had better have thinking out loud in it if you're one of the conversational tone. But if that's all you've got, then you've missed the boat. In Birches, let's take a look at Birches. It's on the next page. And I hope you can, excuse me. Sure.
doesn't the fact that this poem is so open lead you to make other interpretations? interpretations of that if you wanted to.
Yeah.
He leaves it to your, I mean, say you could say, well, that talks about directions in life.
Sure. See? Sure. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And he's not pushing it on you so hard. It leaves more for you to...
That's right. That's right. And a good poet had better be able to do that. That's aesthetic distance. And if you don't have aesthetic distance, if he had said, I took this path and this is what happened and then I became a bank manager, it's all because I took that path. Well, that's fine. So what? That doesn't, as you say, it doesn't let us come into the poem. And this way we can interpret. And another thing, your point is well taken. You notice that he doesn't say what the difference is meant. Could be a bad difference. We always interpret it, say, he went on to be a good man. He took that path that had the weeds and improved his character. He doesn't say that, but an awful lot of people assume that. Well, maybe it was terrible. There's no little aside there saying, by the way, it stinks, that path. Don't take it. He just says that has made all the difference. Knowing when to stop. Yeah.
This seems so easy. Do you have any idea how much time it took him to write one of these? Did he labor over it for years, or did it just come to him?
I don't know this particular poem, but I can tell you, for example, another poem that's similar, if you'd like to maybe look at that just for a minute, Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. I know how long that took him, and that's a similar kind of poem, I think. I thought I had it on here. Is it? Okay. Yeah, thank you. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep. But I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. Now, he was writing that poem, and he started off with, whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. And that took about 5 minutes, because it just kind of comes out. It was just there. He knew what he wanted to say. But then he started on the second stanza, and he stopped in the middle of that and said, what'll I do with my rhyme? And then you can see what he did with his rhyme. He picked up the third line, he will not see me stopping here. And he started rhyming, my little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. And then he put his pencil down. He said, I got something interesting going here. I see the third line is lake, and it doesn't rhyme with queer, near, or year. I wonder if I can keep this going and just take the lake rhyme and end my things with that. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there's some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. I did it. I wonder if I can do it one more time. Well, he didn't, but he started the sweep, the rhyme again. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep. And then those last two very powerful lines that have puzzled all kinds of people, and Frost said, I did it because I liked it. And then I think you got to believe him. And miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. It's not a death wish, probably, as some critics have said. And other kinds of things. They said, I know why you wrote that. And Frost says, yes, I do too. Why don't you ask me? And they did. And then they said, well, you don't really know because you're just a poet. And they proceeded to write what they thought anyway. So that the poem took him about an hour because he was, and it needn't have taken that long. He just was kind of playing with a lot of rhymes. He'd write some words in the corner of his paper and try those things out. Like most poets, you write things, or not only poets, but writers. You write a line, you something over here, and then you have little arrows remind you to put that down here. And a lot of people rewrite that way as you go. And he did it as after he'd started, more as an exercise than anything else. He just wanted to see if he could play around with those words and see if it'd come out right. He thought it was kind of fun to be able to do that and still say something rather nice. So it didn't take long. So some poems will take a few minutes, and some will take forever. Like Dylan Thomas, for example. I was talking about him with somebody the other day. His poems are so romantic and so lush. Fern Hill, for example, is maybe the best lyric poem of the 20th century for me. And it just has all kind of spontaneity, as we were talking about last night, in it. And yet, as he sat in his little fishing village in Wales, little hut atop this cliff overlooking the estuary, he was writing and writing and writing until finally he got almost a goose egg knot on his hand, finger, from writing and rewriting. And he would finally stumble out of that and go for a walk down in the bay. And Catlin, his wife, would go up, open the door, and sweep out all these little balls of paper that he would, you know, do that and throw it out. And sometimes they were knee-deep. Looking back on that, if she only knew what she was sweeping out, there are museums, you know, that would give pay for those. And she just swept them right out into the, down over the cliff. So he would rewrite sometimes a poem 200 times. 300 times, 400 times, one poem to get it right. And every time he crossed out a word, every time he changed a word, he would rewrite the whole poem. Hemingway rewrote Farewell to Arms 5 times. When he made a change, he'd rewrite the novel. So a lot of this spontaneity, as many, Herb and others said last night, there's structure behind it. That's how you get the spontaneity. You know, it's like anything in your business or anybody's, whatever you do. The better you are, the easier it tends to look to other people. And say, boy, she got it soft, you know, I wish I could do that. Well, yes, you can if you prepare, that kind of stuff. I'm not sure that answered the question. I don't remember the question. What was it?
Just how long did it take?
Oh, yeah. To heck with the question, right? Yeah, it takes different times. Some poems require... like novels, some poems and novels require years. We saw The Ship of Fools last week or 2 weeks ago. Yeah, it takes different times. Some poems require, like novels, some poems and novels require years. We saw The Ship of Fools last week or 2 weeks ago, and Catherine Ann Porter, I've forgotten now just how long, but she left that book, and for a year or two, I've forgotten what it was, but she came back to it and picked up and started in mid-sentence and mid-paragraph and continued on with it.
When you're writing, or when he's writing, or somebody else, does he write? Does he keep notes? Does stopping by the woods, does that happen while he's stopping by the woods, or does he go back? And I think Norman Rockwell once said, the way he works in painting, he gets up at 7 in the morning and goes to a shop and just starts painting. I gather like this, at least this happens when he's actually doing it, or does he go back more mechanically and just think it?
Well, I don't know for sure, but so you have to be careful when you make these kind of pontifical statements. They're easy to make, and you got to be careful, because, and if you don't know, I think you ought to say, and I don't know, but an educated guess, I would doubt very much he wrote that on the spot. Very, very difficult to sit in a buggy when it's snowing and write a poem. Simply because you're too busy, your senses are too open to what's going on. Wordsworth said it eloquently, and I always foul up that great quote. What is that great quote of Wordsworth? I'll paraphrase. On the couch, when he's quiet, and then the emotion comes back to me, and then I write the poem. I wish I could. I'm gonna have to write that down on my underwear, someplace where I'll, or my watch, because it's a beautiful statement. When I first went to Concordia College in Seward, Nebraska to teach creative writing for the first time, first semester I ever tried it, I really thought that was the thing to do. I said, everybody get your clipboard, we're going to Plum Creek and we're going to write poems. Mm-hmm. Everybody said, way good. And so out we went down to Plum Creek, and I said, you got 2 hours, just find a nice spot and write. And one kid climbed a tree and assumed a very arty position in there. A couple of kids went under a bush. Another went down and dangled his feet in the water on the bridge. And a couple wandered off after a couple of ponies up the stubbled corn that had been cut. It was in October. Very pretty. And I was beaming proudly about all this. And I had my clipboard. Well, an hour and a half later, I was standing there in the corn with my clipboard with nothing on it. So I started walking around, and I looked up the tree, and there was the kid up in the tree, just kind of like this, looking at the geese overhead. I hadn't written a word. The kid on the bridge had taken his shoes off and was just kind of watching and stirring the water with a stick. There was nothing on his clipboard. Two other kids walked 5 miles after the ponies, and they were late. I never did see them that day. But nobody wrote anything. So that was a good lesson for me, and I never have forgotten it, that I can never write anything while I'm doing it. And as a matter of fact, my poems take months, if not years, to come. A book of poems I wrote on our bicentennial trip last summer, I wrote 7-8 months after the fact. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wrote a poem, I'm writing some poems now, just before I went on the European tour, 10 poems about my childhood in the Lutheran school in Inglewood, California. And that was 30 plus years ago. So, yes. So the psyche brings those things up. Sometimes you just can't hurry it sometimes. But you don't write on the spot, very rarely. You can take notes, and a lot of people keep a journal. I think that's a good idea, although I don't, but an awful lot of people do. And you
are
can,
you consciously aware that this might be a poem at a later time?
Sometimes, but not very often. Very rarely. Spitz Ruprecht last week, just under the bell, this is one of the guests that was up here last week, just told a story, and I was just one of a few people listening. He was telling a story how in Valparaiso, Indiana, a year or so, or this year, or when, fairly recently, a deer came out of a park. And is it Tittle's supermarket, Liz, or something? And this deer somehow got into the supermarket and panicked and crashed through glass and cut himself all up, and they had to subdue him and take him out and had to be destroyed. And it was just a story he was telling, but there was something about that story that immediately gripped me, and I couldn't wait to get to a pencil and write the poem. And the poem came out. But that is rare that happens. And I have all my creative writing students usually come to me thinking that's exactly the way that writing is done, that you're raped by the muse constantly, and you must be inspired. And that rarely ever happens that way. When that happens, that's grace. Mostly it's just sweating it out, and an editor says, I will publish this if you'll get it to me by Tuesday. That's the way I write best. And I know it's Tuesday, then I can sit down and do it. Deadline is a great muse.
On this line, it's interesting. A few minutes ago, I was talking to her broker, a conversation with all this, well, what kind of summer do you really have?
I said,
you know, it's been very creative. I said, oh, have you done the drugs? I haven't done it.
Oh.
Yeah. He said, I'm taking everything in.
Yeah. I know what he means. Mm-hmm. Another thing, some of my, I don't know why I'm talking about my writing students. I hadn't come today intending to do that, but it seems like I can make a point. A lot of them, not only do they take notes, they always take notes. I've got a couple who just go around constantly all day at CLC, this little pad, and they look at people, write it down, and look you in the eye. And I feel like I'm being sleuthed. Sherlock Holmes is. And you can't do that either. You just can't go around looking for that poem. I tell them, you just got to do what you do, whether you're a pharmacist or an attorney or a teacher or a minister or a plumber or a bum or whatever, but do your thing. And it's like a dog going into the woods. Your coat will pick up burrs. Your psyche will pick up things that are poems. And don't worry about it. They'll be there. And the hardest thing to do is to get kids to realize that their own childhood is, and what they've done before I've ever seen them in college. That's going to be the subject matter that's going to see them through the rest of their life, those memories. And they always, almost always say, oh, not my, I didn't do anything. My childhood is just bourgeois, really dumb. Not so. But it'll take 30 years, maybe, before that starts to seep up. You know how that is. And if they're going to write at all, that'll be the wellspring. Well, talked about some neat stuff. You want to do Death of a Hired Man? Just take a look at that.
I'm
like the dimpled spider.
The dimpled spider?
Can you imagine a dimpled spider?
All right, well, let's take a quick look at that one, because that's...
Design.
Yes, design on the bottom of the page, stopping by Woods. That's Frost Dark Side. And I put one of those in there. Do you have a question?
No.
Let's see, is this a sonnet? Yeah, this is another sonnet. You all find it? Bottom of the page, called Design. Design, bottom of the page, that has Stopping by Woods on it. About three lines in the bottom of that page. I found a dimpled spider, fat and white, on a white heel all, holding up a moth like a white piece of rigid satin cloth. Assorted characters of death and blight mixed ready to begin the morning rite, like the ingredients of a witch's broth. A snowdrop spider, a flower like a froth, and dead wings carried like a paper kite. What had that flower to do with being white, the wayside blue and innocent heel all? What brought the kindred spider to that height, then steered the white moth thither in the night? What but design of darkness to appall, if design govern in a thing so small?
He uses the word fat so many times, it's just amazing.
Yes, yeah.
Five times.
Yeah. Word white? Yeah. And light, right? Everything has a very white aura to it. A flower like a froth, a snowdrop spider, dead wings carried like a paper kite. All these are white, or rather frothy, light, airy images. But he's talking about death. He's talking about that spider and that moth. And then the frost doesn't overwrite again, though. It's really a tragedy in microcosm. And what brought them together? Well, design. It's kind of a parody on Browning again. You know, God's in his heaven and all's right with the world. Well, how nice. If you've got money and you live on the right side of town, it's very nice. And Emily Dickinson did the same thing in her poem yesterday. What was it? The bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. And turned sidewise, let a beetle pass, and drank a dew from a convenient grass. That's just the opening lines of the poem. And that's saying the same thing. How nice to have God, or whoever, to have provided this little angleworm at the precise time this bird came down. He just licked down, grabbed the poor fellow, ate him raw, turned his head once sidewise, and there's a little dew on a grass, and off he goes. That God's in his heaven, all right with the world. And just state that this, and you get the message without belaboring it, I think. It's bitter. There's a pain there. Mm-hmm. And but if you remember you're dealing with art and poetry, you don't write a treatise. You don't write a dissertation. You don't nail your thumb to the door with the other theses. You just make your statement and back off. Once in a while, poets forget to do that, like anybody else. There's a great example of... By Robinson Jeffers, a great American poet who lived near Carmel, California. And he wrote a poem called The Purse Seine, which is a brilliant poem. You know, the purse seine, those boats that go out fishing, they unfurl their nets in the back, and then they bring the fish in. And he has this poem about the fish coming in, and when the fish first realize they're in a net, and they start beating their tails like comets, and the water is all phosphorescent and glowing because the net's coming up tighter and tighter, and the fish are coming up tighter in a circle, and they're all beating the water. On the outside of the nets, a couple of sea lions come up with great, sad, drooping eyes, and their long whiskers and tushes, and they make kind of a moans, and they sink slowly into the sea as if they take pity on the fact that their brothers, the fish, are being... And that's a brilliant poem. Then he says, so it was when I, and he goes on to overwrite in the most horrible way. And you wonder how, because he wanted to make the point so strongly. He said, I was standing on one of the mountains overlooking a city, and I saw the city coming up, and doors being locked, and gears locked into place, and walls moving, and cars. And you know what he was trying to say. The metaphor was the fish, and it was like me, see? But it was obvious, and he forgot that. He ruled that you don't say that kind of thing. And anybody can spot that a mile. It's still a good poem, but it's just not necessary. I usually show my students that as an example how not to overwrite. Then I tell them when it took place in Los Angeles in 1924. That really kills them. Imagine standing on a hill in 1924 looking at Los Angeles feeling trapped. I can't breathe. There's too many people down there. In 1924. If you're Robinson Jeffers, two people is too many. One other person would have to go. In fact, he hated people so much, he told his boys, don't go to San Francisco or Los Angeles. Stay in Big Sur, Carmel. Don't go to the cities, because he says, man is an insufferable master. And look what happened to Jesus. He really lays it on him. Death of a Hired Man. I hope we can read all this through. Sometimes the ditto gets... Mary sat musing on the lamp flame at the table waiting for Warren. When she heard his step, she ran on tiptoe down the darkened passage to meet him in the doorway with the news and put him on his guard. Silas is back. She pushed him outward with her through the door and shut it after her. Be kind, she said. She took the market things from Warren's arms and set them on the porch, then drew him down to sit beside her on the wooden steps. When was I ever anything but kind to him? But I'll not have the fellow back, he said. I told him last hang, didn't I? If he left then, I said that ended it. What good is he? Who else will harbor him at his age for the little he can do? What help he is, there's no depending on. Off he goes, always when I need him most. He thinks he ought to earn a little pay, enough at least to buy tobacco with, so he won't have to beg and be beholden. All right, I say, I can't afford to pay any fixed wages, though I wish I could. Someone else can, and someone else will have to. I shouldn't mind his bettering himself, if that's what it was. You can be certain when he begins like that, there's someone at him trying to coax him off with pocket money in haying time, when any help is scarce. In winter he comes back to us. I'm done. Shh, not so loud. He'll hear you, Mary said. I want him to. He'll have to soon or late. He's worn out. He's asleep beside the stove. When I came up from Rose, I found him here, huddled against the barn door fast asleep. A miserable sight, and frightening too. You needn't smile. I didn't recognize him. I wasn't looking for him, and he's changed. Wait till you see. Where did you say he'd been? He didn't say. I dragged him to the house and gave him tea and tried to make him smoke. I tried to make him talk about his travels. Nothing would do. He just kept nodding off. What did he say? Did he say anything? But little. Well, anything. Mary, confess. He said he'd come to ditch the meadow for me. Warren. But did he? I just want to know. Of course he did. What would you have him say? Surely you wouldn't grudge this poor old man some humble way to save his self-respect. He added, if you really care to know, he meant to clear the upper pasture, too. That sounds like something you've heard before. Warren, I wish you could have heard the way he jumbled everything. I stopped to look two or three times. He made me feel so queer. To see if he was talking in his sleep. He ran on Harold Wilson, you remember? The boy you had in haying 4 years since? He's finished school and teaching in his college. Silas declares you'll have to get him back. He says they two will make a team for work. Between them, they will lay this farm as smooth, the way he mixed that in with other things. He thinks young Wilson a likely lad, though daft on education. You know how they fought all through July under the blazing sun, Silas up on the cart to build the load, Harold along beside to pitch it on. Yes, I took care to keep well out of earshot. Well, those days trouble Silas like a dream. You wouldn't think they would, how some things linger. Harold's young college boy's assurance piqued him. After so many years, he still keeps finding good arguments he sees he might have used. I sympathize. I know just how it feels to think of the right thing to say too late. Harold's associated in his mind with Latin. He asked me what I thought of Harold saying he studied Latin like the violin because he liked it. That an argument. He said he couldn't make the boy believe he could find water with a hazel prong, which showed how much good school had ever done him. He wanted to go over that. But most of all, he thinks if he could have another chance to teach him how to build a load of hay. I know, that's Silas's one accomplishment. He bundles every forkful in its place and tags and numbers it for future reference so he can find and easily dislodge it in the unloading. Silas does that well. He takes it out in bunches like big birds' nests. You never see him standing on the hay he's trying to lift, straining to lift himself. He thinks if he could teach him that, he'd be some good perhaps to someone in the world. He hates to see a boy the fool of books. Poor Silas, so concerned for other folk and nothing to look backward to with pride and nothing to look forward to with hope. So now and never any different. Part of a moon was falling down the west, dragging the whole sky with it to the hills. Its light poured softly in her lap. She saw and spread her apron to it. She put out her hand among the harp-like morning glory strings, taut with the dew from garden bed to eaves, as if she played unheard some tenderness that wrought on him beside her in the night. "Warren," she said, "he has come home to die. You needn't be afraid he'll leave you this time." "Home," he mocked gently. "Yes, what else but home? It all depends on what you mean by home. Of course, he's nothing to us any more than was the hound that came a stranger to us out of the woods, worn out upon the trail. Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I should have called it something you somehow haven't to deserve." Warren leaned out and took a step or two, picked up a little stick and brought it back and broke it in his hand and tossed it by. "Silas has better claim on us, you think, than on his brother. 13 little miles, as the road winds, would bring him to his door. Silas has walked there that far, no doubt, today. Why didn't he go there? His brother's rich, a somebody, director in the bank. He never told us that. We know it, though. I think his brother ought to help, of course. I'll see to it if there is need. He ought of right to take him in and might be willing to. He may be better than appearances. But have some pity on Silas. Do you think if he had any pride in claiming kin or anything he looked for from his brother, he'd keep so still about him all this time? I wonder what's between them. I can tell you. Silas is what he is. We wouldn't mind him, but just the kind the kinsfolk can't abide. He never did a thing so very bad. He don't know why he isn't as good as anybody, worthless though he is. He won't be made ashamed to please his brother. I can't think Si ever hurt anyone. No, but he hurt my heart the way he lay and rolled his old head on the sharp-edged chair back. He wouldn't let me put him on the lounge. You must go in and see what you can do. I made the bed up for him there tonight. You'll be surprised at him, how much he's broken. His working days are done, I'm sure of it. I'd not be in a hurry to say that. I haven't been. Go, look, see for yourself. But Warren, please remember how it is. He's come to help you ditch the meadow. He has a plan. You mustn't laugh at him. He may not speak of it, and then he may. I'll sit and see if that small sailing cloud will hit or miss the moon. It hit the moon. Then there were three there, making a dim row. The moon, the little silver cloud, and she. Warren returned too soon, it seemed to her. Slipped to her side, caught up her hand, and waited. "Warren," she questioned. "Dead," was all he answered. Well, that's rather a solemn note to end on, but that's Robert Frost. And there's a great line in that poem, and I'm sure it stands out. It does for me all the time. Home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. I don't know if that matches your definition of home, but it's rather hard to refute. So I hope this has been enjoyable for you. It has been for me. It always is to talk about Robert Frost. And there's so many more that you can read. Happy, somber, and everything in between. So go and read Robert Frost. Thanks for coming.